Washington, Indiana, we welcome you to the Larry Bouchon Town Hall event. I'm Dave Crooks from Memories 107.9. Our moderator tonight will be Dan Murray, the prosecutor in Daviess County. And as the public enters the auditorium tonight, they are filling out questions, which Dan will take a peek at, and he will be using those tonight. So let's introduce our county prosecutor, Dan Murray.
Good evening, everyone. I am Dan Murray. I am the prosecutor here in Daviess County, and I want to welcome everyone to this great forum tonight. I want to encourage those of you who haven't filled out a question to go ahead and do that. And we are going to have a process where I will read the written question, and then I will hand the microphone over to Congressman Bouchon, who will then answer it. And we will go from there. We may or may not have time at the end to do some free flow questions or not, but we are going to go with the written questions for sure. Now, if your question is strikingly similar to another question, we may not ask both of them, particularly if the congressman's answer covers it. But we will try to get through all of them in the time allotted for us. You know, this is Daviess County, and what we're really asking for, too, is for everyone to be respectful of everyone's opinion and position on items, and that basically that we approach this in a professional manner, and that we actually take advantage of democracy at work here and the congressman's willingness to come in and speak to all of us and take questions from his constituents. And that's something that we should all be extraordinarily grateful for, in my personal opinion, that we have the ability to reach out to someone who's in Washington, D.C., and making important decisions for all of us. So if you'd give me a moment, I'm going to confer here. I will get the first set of written questions, and we will begin this forum. All right. All right. I see my friend Blake Chambers over here. When we were trying cases back in the day, Blake, I didn't have to wear these glasses, and now I do. So, well, all right. The first question is from John Perry, who lives here in Green Acres here in Washington. His question is, why do you back the new health care bill when only 11% of Americans supported it and only 6% thought it was a great bill? Why did Congress put taxpayers in the bill? So, tax breaks in the bill.
Well, that's a good question. First of all, welcome, everyone, and I really thank you for coming out. Last time I did a town hall here, I think Dave was there. We had like seven people. So tonight, it's really important that you're all here because these forums are important. And I do these across the district. Washington is a great city, right in the middle of my district, and so it's great to be here. So you asked the question. So first of all, I'm going to give you a little background on my, and I think many of you in here know my views on healthcare. I was a heart surgeon before for 12 years, and so I ran for Congress so that I could have some impact on healthcare, so I can try to make sure that everybody had access and insurance for quality, affordable health care. And we have a challenge with that in our country, even today. At the time I ran, we had 45 million people uninsured. Right now we're about 25 to 26 million uninsured. And others are on a Medicaid program, which has been expanded and still limits access. The Affordable Care Act, in my opinion, has some problems. There's some good things in it. Covering pre-existing conditions, children until age 26, closing the Medicare donut hole. I was for those things before the law. I'm still for those things. And I want to make sure that people have affordable health care. I had patients with pre-existing conditions that couldn't get coverage, and it wasn't right. Lifetime caps where if you spent $1 million, you were really sick, and then after that you didn't have insurance, that was a bad problem that got corrected by the Affordable Care Act. And I still support those ideas. Right now what's happening, though, if you look across the country, the exchanges, and we're dealing with about 10 million of our fellow citizens in the exchanges, roughly. So there's different parts of the law. I'm going to address each separately. the 10 to 12 million that are in exchanges, depending on the year, are in trouble because the insurance companies are dropping out of the exchanges. And the reason they're doing that is because they're losing a lot of money. They're losing billions of dollars. And whether we like it or not, the insurance industry is a business, and these are publicly held companies, and they're going to make these decisions. And the reason why they're losing money is because the young, essentially young people aren't signing up. They estimated about 40% of the people that have signed up for the exchanges would be age 35 and under, and somewhere around 28 to 30% are actually 35 and under. And what that means is that old patients who are older and have more health problems are a bigger percentage of that pool of patients than was estimated. And so what that does is it drives up costs for everybody. And as costs go up, less people enroll. And so what's happening right now is big insurance companies are getting out of the exchanges and leaving patients with few options. In fact, across the country, you know, we're down to half the counties in the country, roughly, only have two choices in the exchanges, and a bunch of places there's only one. So the premise was there'd be competition, there'd be all these policy options, and that's just not happening. And so deductibles are higher, premiums are higher, and what's happening because of that is that's spilling over into the employer-insured marketplace. Roughly somewhere around 170 million of our fellow citizens get their insurance through their employer. That's a big that's a big chunk of where we get our insurance. And because of what's happening in the exchanges on the health care law, the deductibles and the premiums on those policies have been rising, making it more difficult for employers and employees to afford it. And so that's the background. And so in my view, you know, we have to do something. And people say to me all the time, well, why don't you work in a bipartisan way to fix the problems in the Affordable Care Act? And that's what we're trying to do, because the things I mentioned at the outset, we don't want to get rid of. But the problem is there's such a fundamental disagreement between the parties about the role of the federal government in healthcare, that when we try to propose certain solutions, we can't get people to approach it. For example, you have extremes all the way from one side of the Republican Party that would get the government out of healthcare altogether and say it's not in the Constitution, all the way to Senator Sanders, who wants the federal government just to take over the whole system. And so trying to find consensus on making quote-unquote changes to the law is almost impossible. So in my view, a good portion of the law needs to be repealed. And we need to reestablish a private sector marketplace. Remember, it's only about 10 or 12 million people. And do that in a way that is more private sector driven. Still offer people, rather than subsidies for an exchange, refundable tax credits, which is very similar. Just it's a technical difference. So that people can afford, people that buy policies on the individual marketplace can afford to do that. But the big problem is that we need to get the deductibles down and the premiums down. I support making those changes. I mean, I think that if we don't do anything, in 2018, by 2018. People in the exchanges aren't going to have any options. So really not doing anything is not really a good option. I think, unfortunately, you know, the political climate across our country amongst all of our citizens and amongst Congress is so polarized that it makes it very difficult to find an area of agreement. And so now you were talking about taxes. Here's what our legislation also repealed: all of the Obamacare taxes that were added in Obamacare, which is about $1 trillion in taxes over the next 10 years, and that's how Washington, D.C. does budgeting over a 10-year budget window. So, and that included some of the things that you know, that you pointed out, there was a tax put on people whose income was higher, $200,000 for an individual, $250,000 for a family. Above that, you had a 0.9% FICA tax increase. Okay, so everybody that made more than that, their Medicare taxes and that went up. And then there was a tax on also a surtax on people that had investment income. And I know those are the things that are what you're talking about. And those, yes, those were repealed. But also the medical device tax, which is really important for our state because we have a big medical device industry. All kinds of other, you know, other taxes, over 20 of them, I don't have the list, were repealed. And the reason for that is because I believe that taxes should be as low as possible on the American people of all incomes. And I think it's, you know, I think it's unfortunate that we continue to have this, you know, that type of political rhetoric, because the reality is that when you add all these taxes, you know, and they're going into a healthcare program that is circling the drain, we're throwing our money away. So, I'm sure I'll ask her another healthcare question later. It's more complicated than that, but the reality is that if we don't do anything, we're gonna have problems. Now, Healthy Indiana Plan was the Medicaid expansion in Indiana. If you follow me, you know I supported that. I supported Governor Pence making the expansion from the Affordable Care Act. And I still support that because it's a state-based way to manage the Medicaid program versus just saying expand traditional Medicaid, which I was against, because it's a program that is struggling financially, and it makes it difficult for people to have access to health care. There are people that have traditional Medicaid but have a hard time finding primary care physicians that will take new Medicaid patients. And that's just the facts. But Healthy Indiana Plan, which I support, still do, and don't want to go away, was a state-based way to make to cover about 300,000, of our fellow citizens, and do it in a state-based way that was more cost-effective, reimburses providers at a higher level so that they'll take it. I'm still in Washington making sure whatever we do with a repeal and replace, that Indiana continues to have the ability to keep Healthy Indiana Plan in the future. Now, there is one thing. The Affordable Care Act reimbursed the states 100% of the cost to expand, and that is slowly going down to 90%. From a federal official standpoint, that's not a sustainable position. So all we're saying is that the regular portion that the federal government pays for Medicaid, which right now, if you're on Medicaid, you go to the hospital, there's a bill, the federal government pays 2/3 of it in the state of Indiana, 66% of the bill, the state pays the rest. All we're saying is, going forward, if states, whichever that could be Indiana or any other state, want to continue to have the expansion, all we're saying is that you have to get the regular match rates, whatever your state is. And states vary from 50% to 70-some percent, believe it or not. They're all different. It's not the same in each state. So that's all we're saying. We're not saying you can't do that. Well, we're just saying from a federal official standpoint, you know, the states are going to have to look at that at the state level and take the regular match. The reason is because Medicaid expenditures at the federal level in 10 years will be $1 trillion a year, which is roughly three times what they are today. Let me put it into context. If you look at the federal budget, the Department of Defense and all other federal programs, discretionary programs, ones that we fund every year, that we have to fund every year, right now we only spend $1.1 to $1.2 trillion on all of that. Medicaid is a mandatory spending program, which is part of the 60% of the rest of the budget, but including the other programs like Medicare and Social Security. So look at it this way. In 10 years, Medicaid alone will, at the federal level, will be an expenditure of almost the entire amount that we're spending on our Defense Department and every other discretionary federal program today. And so there's, you know, we're in a tough spot. I mean, there's some options. Some of it's going to be things like we're trying to do with right now with the expansion population, but some of it is we're going to have to make some more decisions. This isn't the end of this. I mean, we're going to all, as a society, have to make some tough decisions on how we're going to continue to fund these programs, which are absolutely necessary. We have to have the Medicaid program. It has to be there for the populations that it was intended for. We have to have a strong Medicare program. And then the last thing I'll say on this one, Dan, and then we'll go to the next question, is the big problem we have is the cost of health care itself is too high. Okay, we're chasing with insurance coverage a product which is too expensive in the first place, right? So it doesn't make sense to continue to just chase trying to cover everyone, we should try to cover everyone, without also addressing the other real problem, which is getting the overall cost of healthcare down itself. And so I'm working on that. One of the ways to make that happen is price transparency. All of us in this room should know what our healthcare products cost us. And so that is a difficult one. It's getting better. But we should be able to know, if we're going to the hospital for something, we should be able to know what that costs. And even though we're only paying maybe our deductible and the insurance company's paying the rest, I think if we're going to get the cost down, we need to start attention to, okay, how much is my insurance company going to have to pay for this? Because it drives up the cost for everybody if we don't. So I'm working on ideas to try to bend the cost curve on the product itself, not only health insurance, but health care, to get the cost down. And I think we can do that. We spend more money in our country per citizen than any other country in the world. It's not even close. Now, I would argue that's because our health care system, the way we pay for it is messed up. But the care itself is the best in the world. That's why people come from all over the world to come here. So.
All right, question number two comes from Donna in Elnora. Do you believe that Trump should release his tax returns to prove he wasn't using his office for financial gain?
Yes, he should. He should release them.
All right, this is from Jamin Britton. What are your thoughts and plans regarding the Minors Protection Act of 2017?
Here's the problem we're dealing with. And for my dad, by the way, is a retired United mine worker, UMWA coal miner for almost 34 years. The pension, the health care and pension funds, is that?
Yeah, there's actually more where she wants to know.
Okay, keep going. I didn't see the back end. The union coal miners will end. My understanding is that as the funding for these programs will end in 9 days unless action is taken, and many retired miners.
Yeah, that's the health care part. For UMW, certain United Mine Workers health care plans, and we're not going to let that happen. And Senator McConnell has said we're going to get up on the health care side, and I agree with them, that we're going to get a permanent solution. Now, legislation that I'm a co-sponsor with in the House is by David McKinley, Republican from West Virginia, as a one possible way to address both health care and the pension situation. But, when we get back to Washington next week, I'm going to be pushing hard to make sure that the funding that we do for the rest of this fiscal year, which ends September 30th, includes funding for the UMWA healthcare situation. I'd like to get a permanent solution to it. It's a very complicated problem, I'm empathetic because everybody I knew growing up is a coal miner. My dad's a UMWA coal miner. He's not on this particular plan, but because he's older. But we need to solve the problem, absolutely. And we've been working on it. I've tried to get the companies, the bigger companies, to help address it over the last year, and we haven't really gotten anywhere because it's a difficult issue. I know, though, that Senator McConnell is committed to solving this problem, and so am I. The pension part is not as an acute problem, like it's not going to go away tomorrow, but it's a problem that needs to be solved because not only the UMWA pension, the United Mine Workers Pension Fund, the particular one, but believe it or not, something like 1,400 pension funds across the country, multi-employer pension funds they're called, where there's different companies that contribute into the pension, are in trouble. And that's a more difficult problem to solve, a bigger problem. So, and Congress on both parties has been trying to figure that out. It's just over the years, just on the UMWA side, less and less UMWA coal miners putting money into the pension fund and an ever-increasing number of retirees that depend on it. And so I'm committed to solve that problem also. It's a bigger problem to solve because of so many other pension funds across the country. I almost had a fix 4 years ago myself, and I had Speaker Boehner convinced on the House side to deal with it, specifically UMWA. And what happened is over on the Senate side, the Senate leadership at the time said, well, you know, we can't pick winners and losers, and so it didn't go through. But we were close. So we're going to fix it. I'm committed to that.
Okay, this is from Ed in Mount Vernon. Thanks for hosting Academy Days. Any this year?
Yeah, we will likely sometime in the fall. And this will, I'll be brief because this is a technical question. That Academy Days are where I have people from the service academies come and have high school students come and get essentially a lecture on what it means to join a service academy, Naval Academy, West Point, and how the process works. And yes, later this year we'll have another one.
This question is from Mark in Washington. Please explain how you would attack the opiate addiction issue.
That's a big problem, but if you see last year, Congress actually passed opioid legislation. What we did is there's a multitude of fronts. One is on the treatment side, people that are already addicted, and there's a lot of those people. That's where I came in. The legislation that actually got signed by President Obama, a lot of on the treatment side was what I did in my office, increasing access to outpatient treatment and expanding outpatient treatment options for people who are addicted to narcotics, medication-assisted treatment. Rather than just the methadone program, there's some other medications that are now available that primary care doctors and others can be helpful with. But as part of that, we wanted to make sure, though, that the providers that are doing that have the qualifications and the paperwork necessary to make sure that they're properly treating people, and they're not just handing out medicines without any follow-up. So as a big part of that, we have criteria in there that if you want to treat a large number of addicted patients, you have to meet certain criteria, have certain training, and also you have to develop an individual treatment plan for each patient so that it's not just handing out a medicated-assisted treatment, which helps them get off the narcotic, but a long-term plan which includes counseling, follow-up, really almost lifelong. This is a lifelong problem. And then, you can get more information off my official website about what that legislation did at the federal level. And then, in the end of the last year, when we did unfortunately a continuing resolution to fund the government through the end of this April, we put our money where our mouth is. We put a bunch of money into that, so that the federal government can help the state, specifically, so the states can access federal dollars, and treatment centers can access federal dollars. To get people into treatment. On the other side of this, on the front end of this, trying to prevent people from getting in trouble in the first place. On the prescription drug side of that, I've met with the people that represent medical schools across the country, and talked with them about medical school curriculums, as well as residency program curriculum, as it relates to treating pain. As physicians, how to properly treat pain, and because that's a big issue. I was a surgeon, and in all my medical training, I never had one class, one period of time in residency or medical school that specifically focused on the proper way to prescribe these narcotic medications for people with pain and how to manage that. And I was a surgeon. Obviously, I did surgery on people. People had all kinds of pain. I kind of learned that on the fly, so to speak. So I've talked to them, and the good news is they're getting these things into curriculum. So on the front end, as it relates to prescription drugs, the prescribing patterns of physicians, I think, are going to get better. Not that they're not going to prescribe medicines for people who have chronic pain. We want to make sure that's the case, that they can. But we also want to be more discriminatory about how people hand these up. I mean, full disclosure, I had surgery myself about 8 years ago, and I got a prescription, you know, for 60 Percocet, and I never took any of them. And I never even turned it in. But that happens, you know, and I didn't need it. And so we got to get that improved. Curriculums help physicians on how to properly manage pain and the use of narcotics on the front end. And then there are some other law enforcement things that the state and local law enforcement are doing, it's not part of what I'm doing at the federal level, but that's what we're doing.
All right, this is another ACA question from Shelley from Washington. As a small business owner with a medical debt accumulated before the ACA was approved, I finally have affordable health care insurance and I want to remain on ACA to remain. However, I recognize improvement is possible and necessary. For example, being able to join with other small business owners and contract for coverage for ourselves and our employees would help us compete with larger business owners. Do you believe that those improvements are possible?
Yes, short answer. And that's one of the things the bipartisan ideas that we're trying to get through Congress is allow small businesses to pool all across the country to join together so that they can have a large pool of people that then they can negotiate with insurance companies on the policies. And, you know, big companies have that, right? If you have a company that has 5,000 employees, you know, insurance companies will give you a pretty good deal on how to cover your employees. But if you have 10 or 15, it's more difficult. And so that is one of the ideas that has been around for a long time and needs to happen. And so the other thing is that, you know, as I said at the outset, I'm pretty concerned that the insurance companies are going to drop out of the exchanges and leave people without any options in a lot of areas. And some business people are having their employees and themselves get insurance on the exchange. And if it's worked for you, that's great. We don't want to pull the rug out from that. But what we also don't want to do is have the exchanges go away and then you not have any options. Because remember, when the ACA came in, the people that had small group and individual policies, about 4 or 5 million of those went away because they didn't comply with the new law. And then, as long as you had a policy that you didn't change, you could stay on it and grandfather and stay on your policy. That's still true today. Last year, 19 million people either got a waiver from the health care law or paid the penalty. Roughly 7 million, I don't have the exact number, roughly 7 million people paid the IRS penalty because they didn't have insurance, and then roughly the rest of those, about 12 million, had waivers from the ACA. But making sure that the prices for small business as well as large businesses is extremely important. And the only way I see to do that is to make them more competitive by having them be able to negotiate based on larger volume of people.
This question is from Deborah in Jasper. As a medical professional, what is your approach on mental health in our country? How should it be funded?
A lot of it is funded by the government, Medicaid. If you look at most mental health, at the end of the day, because it's a chronic, long-standing disease. At the end of the day, most patients that have severe mental illness end up on the Medicaid program, so we need to make sure the Medicaid program continues to cover people that have long-term mental illness. Because, from my – and I work on this because again, I'm one of the doctors in Congress, and I'm on the Committee of Jurisdiction. And a guy named Tim Murphy, who's a clinical psychologist, who's a member of Congress from the Pittsburgh area, works on this a lot and really is really the tip of the spear in a bipartisan way to try to increase access to health for health coverage and health care for people that have mental illness. And there are some challenges there. We've tried to adjust the what are called HIPAA laws, privacy laws, to allow to help parents of adult children that have mental illness have a little bit of access to their child's medical decision-making process, and we haven't been able to get that changed because people are afraid of violating people's privacy, which I get. It's important, but also recognize people with severe mental illness don't have the ability to make that decision. So we've tried to make all kinds of things, but and there has been laws passed, not just the ACA, but other laws that are to make sure that mental health cover, there's no disparity between mental health problem and if you have a gallbladder problem. I mean, mental health issues are a medical issue just like an appendicitis or gallbladder problems. It's the same thing. And for years, probably decades, unfortunately, there wasn't really parity in the private sector in the health insurance coverage for those. Like I said, most people eventually end up on Medicaid. I support those type of things. We should not do a disservice to our fellow citizens that have mental illness by not covering it. I had a high school friend in my class who developed schizophrenia in her mid-20s. She had two kids, was married, suddenly had schizophrenia, ended up on the street, and her husband left her, moved out of the state. She lost absolutely everything because she had schizophrenia. And I would argue this is, first happened about 30 years ago, that our system failed her. Michelle Bandy was her name. And she died last year at age 54 because people with severe mental illness tend to have that problem because they get other health issues that they don't get addressed. So this is a really big point that both parties in Washington, D.C., are pushing to make sure that people that have these problems have access to, not only access to, but are able to afford to get treatment. It is a difficult problem to solve. People estimate that about half the people in our country that have a disease like schizophrenia get no treatment. And there's reasons for that. It's either because they don't seek it or they don't have access to it or know how to gain access to it because they're not in the system, they're not on Medicaid, they don't have other insurance, and we need to change that. And we're doing everything we can to make that better.
This is from Norma in Washington. Why have you not followed up regarding the lack of air quality monitors in an area with four super polluting plants and special ed rates and increased birth defects? How high do these rates have to go before you acknowledge the effect on health, and why does your policy and views disagree with the AAP and the AMA?
Okay, I don't think it does, because obviously I know that that this area, Southwest Indiana, I mean, we call it the heart attack belt in medicine, right? Because we do have air quality issues. As far as the air quality monitors and stuff, that's decisions made by the executive branch, not the legislative branch. The EPA and others in the executive branch make decisions about where they put air quality monitors. The legislative branch doesn't have a role in that. But here's the thing. Across the country, I think all of us would agree that, you know, we need to continually do better in what our role is in our environment. I don't disagree with that. I think what the big argument in Washington, D.C. has been about, and most Republicans don't either, that's all rhetoric for TV, because the reality is that the difference of opinion is on a timeline of how to accomplish that goal. And I've said this many, many times. What you can't do in this area of the country, and I know some of you don't like it, the fact that that there's a big coal economy here and everything around it, but there is. And people's lives and their jobs and their families and everybody depends on it. And everything that comes after that. Just look what has happened in eastern Kentucky. Restaurants have closed. People have moved out. So my point is this. What I favor is using the best technology that we have available today and have the least impact that we can have that's technologically feasible and continue to innovate and improve going forward. But what you can't, in my opinion, what you can't do is set artificial deadlines that devastate economies in various areas of the country, particularly the Midwest when it relates to things like the Clean Power Plan. And so, you know, it's easy to say if you're from Washington State when you have almost none of your power comes from natural gas or coal, and you have all kinds of energy coming from hydroelectric, that, oh, let's just set a deadline in 2017 because we don't like that where the industry is technologically, and so the best thing we should do is just shut it down. But if you represent an area that, like I do, and it's a representative republic, so I represent my district the best I can, if you set a timeline like that and it devastates the economy in Southwest Indiana and the Wabash Valley, that's not a position that I'm going to take. But I am not also going to take a position where people don't use the most available technology and that is to decrease the impact that we as citizens have on our environment. So it's a balance to be struck, and it's a difficult balance. But that's what we're trying to do.
Okay, this is a follow-up to that. This is from Abby from Jasper. Do you support the current budget proposal, which heavily cuts funding to the EPA?
The budget proposal has a lot of cuts that I don't support. And I've said this to, again, it's a president's budget. President Obama, when he released his budgets, they always spent a lot more money than we currently spend. So when you change presidents and you get President Trump, and I know Mick Mulvaney, he came in with me in the House. He's the director of the office that does the budget. Doesn't surprise me that the budget that came out is as it is. But I'll say this to you, is there's a lot of areas that in their budget they zero out. They cut the funding to the National Institutes of Health by almost $6 billion, which why would you can't do that. We just passed legislation last year to get more money for medical research, right? So what I'll say is there's a lot of things in the budget, but that doesn't mean that's what Congress is going to pass. And so, with the House and the Senate, we'll go through our budget process, which we're in the middle of now, and the proposed budget, likely most of that will not be what's passed into law. Now, do I think the EPA needs some reforms? And yes. The EPA was put in, by the way, under a Republican president in 1973, as was OSHA and all the other environmental agencies were put into law by Republicans in the early 70s. So it's a false narrative, I think, that because there's a few people, on national TV talking about some of these things, that people like me are going to support completely ditching everything that we look at as it relates to our environment. That's just not true. So, like I said, a lot of things in the budget. I talked to a bunch of people last week, week before last in D.C., all kinds of things. Like I said, the big one for me is the National Institutes of Health. So I'm in a wait and see position right now to see what the budget committee in the House and the Senate come up with and what the Appropriations Committee, which actually funds the government, comes up with. But there's a lot of issues with the budget. Now, the reason is and I'll get a little more depth in the budget. The reason is because the president's budget tries to address is a very small part of the overall federal spending, and that's the problem, right? It wants to plus up the Department of Defense. Remember, I told you, Department of Defense discretionary and other discretionary is about 40% of the overall budget. So they want to plus up the Department of Defense, which everyone is telling us that we need to do because the planes are old, the people aren't getting trained the way they should. But then you're not going to balance the rest of the budget on the 20%, which is the other discretionary spending, which is things like EPA, NIH, and other things. So we're going to have to address that. We're early in the House in the budget process.
This question is from Kim from Washington. Do you support funding for the Corporation for National and Community Service?
Yes, I do. That's some of the things they'd zero out, right? Community service block grants, PBS, other things. Their budget zeroes out, and I don't support zeroing those out.
This question is from Jeff from Washington. Senate Bill 8, Civil Asset Forfeiture Revision, passed and was sent to the House. What is the status, and do you or did you support it?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know what that is. Okay, so it's in Indiana, so, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. It's not at the federal level.
This question is from Tara from Jasper. Will you stand up for the American people and the integrity of our system by supporting an independent investigation into the administration's ties to Russia?
That's a popular position, obviously. Yeah. Right now, and you probably won't like my answer, those that do the clap. Here's the truth, of the reality of it, where we are. Okay? First of all, I support an investigation. Absolutely. No doubt, I don't think in anyone's minds that the Russian government tried to influence our election. I don't think that's not disputable. Some of the things that are happening related to that are classified at this point. I haven't even seen all the stuff in the classified information because the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, which are the committees of jurisdiction that related to classified information, are in the middle of an investigation, both the House and the Senate, on that issue. And they've already, in a bipartisan way, agreed to who's coming to testify to those committees. And so at this point, I think what needs to happen, and I think the Senate committee is a little ahead of that. I think, honestly, they have, because of all kinds of different things, they have probably more credibility with the American people than the House Intelligence Committee at this point, related to Chairman Nunes and how he recused himself, which I know him. He's a fine person, but I think it was appropriate to recuse himself. So once they get through that process with the classified stuff and the House and Senate Intelligence Committees get their results out, then we'll have to see where we go. But I'm confident, that the people on those committees, by the way, are people that, in a bipartisan way, wouldn't be on those committees if they didn't have the best interest of our national security as well as the integrity of our election system in mind. Because these are people that I trust to do that. So at this point, let's see what all the classified stuff and see what those intelligence committees come up with. After that, if it's, if things are unclear, really, there's probably not any other committees in the House or the Senate that would be able to take up in a nonpartisan way a further investigation. At that point, I do think the leadership on both sides of the aisle would probably make a decision on a different type of investigation. But first, we got to get through House and Senate intelligence committees.
This question was presented by Logan from Jasper. In a country plagued with increased political polarization, what have you done to bridge the partisan divide?
That's a good question. Well, for the last 6 years, I've been part of a bipartisan working group. When I came in in 2010, there were a bunch of new Republicans and new Democrats. And a friend of mine, Jim Renacci from Northern Ohio, started a group we'll have 10 Republicans, 10 Democrats from those classes, basically from the 2010 and 2012 classes. And we, at that point, for about 4 years, we met monthly, and then over the last couple of years, weekly, to have an open dialogue with our colleagues on both sides. And so that's one of the big things I've done. And also, if you look at some of the things I've done legislatively, it's been done, you know, things that we can find common ground on, we should. Early in my career in Congress, I got about 70% of a bill that I did with a guy named John Carney from Delaware, who's currently the governor of Delaware, about medication shortages. You may or may not know, but across the country we had shortages at hospitals of certain medications, including anesthetic-related agents. When we did an FDA reauthorization in 2011 or 12, I can't remember, about 70% of our ideas that we had to solve that problem made it into law, signed by president. And I have an ongoing dialogue across the aisle with a multitude of friends. One of the ways also that you can do that is try to interact with people in a more social type setting where people are people versus a partisan setting being on the Hill. So for 5 years, I played on a bipartisan congressional hockey team. And that sounds like that doesn't I played ice hockey. But that sounds like, you know, well, how's that going to work? Well, because we had a bipartisan group of people, and you get to know people across the aisle as people. And I try to do that. On the last recess, I went on a bipartisan trip to Japan with four Republicans, four Democrats. We met with the Prime Minister. We met with the Foreign Minister in Tokyo, primarily talking about trade and security issues, which are on the forefront in that region. And on congressional trips like that, there's a couple things that are very important. One is we got to hear directly from the Prime Minister of Japan and other people in Japan about their concerns in the region and with trade with America. But you get to spend time with your colleagues on the other side of the aisle talking to them about all kinds of issues. So I think we are polarized across the country. Our country's pretty polarized. But people in Washington on both sides recognize that, what I'll call myself is a rank-and-file member of the House, that we want to try to build those bridges. And there's areas that we just don't agree on. And there's just areas we're just not going to agree on. Healthcare is really tough. But I do think there's a lot of areas of common ground. I'm hopefully on tax reform. We'll get somewhere. Infrastructure, funding. This year, I mean, the White House is behind a large infrastructure bill. So are both sides of the aisle. So those are the things that I'm doing to try to bridge the gap.
All right. This question is from Jody from Washington. I know the popularity of charter schools with the current administration. What are the plans to heal our public schools?
Yeah, most of those are state-based. Most of the school system stuff is state-based issues, at the federal level, I was on the Education and Workforce Committee for 4 years. I'm not now, so we dealt with some of those things. One of the things that we did, in a bipartisan way, again, I know that's hard to believe because we don't see that on TV. For educators in the room, you probably know this. We replaced No Child Left Behind with a law called Every Student Succeeds Act. And that was a big deal. And what did we do? Some of the testing issues, some of the improvement issues, like what's called annual yearly progress that schools had to comply with at the federal level, which educators told us weren't working, got changed and replaced and allowed state governments and local governments to address education issues closer to the student. So I'm optimistic. I think, you know, I know whoever asked that question probably doesn't like Betsy DeVos, just so you know. I don't know her. And I'm in the House, so I didn't vote for her confirmation. People ask that all the time, did you vote for this person or that? We don't have a vote. But I know that the Congress, addressing issues, has done some pretty big things in the last couple of years. The Every Student Succeeds Act was a huge win, and it garnered support from both sides. It was not a partisan position at all. And I see those ideas continuing to be implemented at the state level. I grew up in a town of 1,500 people in Central Illinois, about 20 miles south of Springfield. I always went to public school. I went to public high school. I went to University of Illinois public school, University of Illinois Medical School, public school. I support whatever schools that can be successful, but I also support, contrary to what, again, the media will tell you, Republicans do support public schools. In fact, tomorrow I'm meeting with David Smith, the superintendent of the Evansville-Vandenberg School Corporation, and have an ongoing dialogue. And a couple of years ago, I did a district-wide education listening session, not with superintendents, but with teachers and some principals, and had a pretty good turnout. Heard a lot of ideas and positive things. One of which at the time was, we're spending too much time testing people all the time, and not enough time in the class, worrying about that. And I think we tried to make some advances at the federal level with that.
This question is from Blake, Washington. What role, if any, do you think Congress should play in decisions to fire missiles into Syria or drop MOABs into Afghanistan?
None. But you can't have now that I'm gonna give a more in-depth answer. I just wanted to say that right up front. Presidents of both political parties have, as the commander in chief, have utilized in the short term things like what happened in Syria. President Obama did the same thing. Presidents of both parties have done that as a short term reaction to the chemical weapons. I thought that what the administration did was measured, was appropriate, and focused on the area that we have the intelligence. And I had a classified briefing by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, so some of the stuff is classified. But what I can say that's in open source is that we had the intelligence to know that the Syrians dropped it. Okay, there's no doubt that they did on their own people, and they're doing that to scare people so that people don't get in the fight. So I thought that was measured. But on that front, the same thing, if you get my press releases, and if you don't, please go to my website and sign up. You also saw that I said any further plans in Syria, the president needs to come to Congress, and we need to have a debate. We need to discuss, and Congress would like to see what our further goals are in Syria. As far as dropping the MOAB, that's a decision by the generals. My understanding is that was a decision by the generals in Afghanistan and not a decision by the president. And you absolutely cannot have Congress looking at every one of those things. I mean, Congress moves so slowly. I mean, it would just be impossible. You have to have the nimbleness to allow, generals in the field and the president in a short term to be able to handle these things. But I think you'll see some discussion of that this week when we get back to D.C. I think you'll see some debate on where we go in Syria. The president has said he doesn't have any further plans as far as changing their strategy in Syria, realizing the United States already has a lot of people in Syria, and that's not because they just got there. They've been there for a long time. They're special forces people that primarily are advising the local forces. But we've got a substantial number of our fellow citizens in Syria, and we have had for a long time. So any change in that strategy, we should debate that in Congress.
This is from Abby from Jasper. Do you believe we should pay for a border wall?
Yes, I do. And the thing about it is, here's what's going to happen. You realize, and I'll just go back. Let me give you a little bit of history. In 2006, Congress already passed legislation to authorize more of a physical barrier along the southern border of our country. That was authorized in 2006. Now, it wasn't subsequently funded at a high level. There's two things that happen in D.C. Something gets authorized, but then it also then the money has to get appropriated to do it. And guess who? And for you know, I'll get a little political here. Guess who voted to do that? Secretary Clinton. Okay, voted for that. Harry Reid voted for that. John Kerry voted for that. People voted for that in a bipartisan way in 2006. That's my point. Okay, but it has to be practical, right? So what's happening? What you have to do now is make a practical assessment. Okay, the goal is to have a stronger physical barrier along the southern border, which I agree with, and look at it in a practical way, and they're already doing that. And areas where it's very clear that in the near future it's doable, we should advance that and then continue to look at the southern border. But here's the thing. That alone is not a strategy for our southern border. And I think everybody in this room recognizes that, regardless of your political affiliation. You need a number of things. We need to decrease the economic incentive for people to come. And the other thing is realize about half the people coming across our southern border right now are not from Mexico. They're from Central America. And I understand why they're coming. But the Mexican government also needs to deal with their porous southern border to a certain extent. We need more border agents, and we need more electronic surveillance along the southern border. And that one other thing we need is more enforcement in what I would call the adjudication of people's cases. You may realize right now there's people come across, they claim asylum because they're being persecuted in Guatemala or wherever. That may be perfectly legitimate. Okay, but what we have is we don't have enough. We're so backlogged on those type of cases that what the Obama administration did that I disagree with is they basically said, here's your court date, and they let them loose in the United States. They didn't enforce immigration. They didn't. I hate to say it, but that's just not, you know, they needed to have a much. You know, they need to beef that up. They need to get their case adjudicated more quickly. But to give people a court date 4 or 5 years out and then just let them stay in the United States is not a good immigration policy. It's just not. No other country in the world does that. Nobody does that. I mean, you know, we're talking about illegal immigration here. We're not talking about the legal immigration system. We take more people in our country every year legally than every other country in the world combined. About 1 million people a year legally. What we're talking about is illegal immigration on the southern border. And the reality is people say, well, barriers don't work. Well, how come Secretary Clinton and Secretary Kerry and all of them voted for it in 2006? It's all political rhetoric. It's political rhetoric to try to create a narrative. Because, you know, what has changed? What has changed now is a president has changed. It's a different president in office. And, you know, the other thing, last thing I'll say on this one is we need to enforce the laws that are on the books. We have laws that deal with all of these things. 40% of people here who are here undocumented came originally legally, either with a student visa or a visa, you know, a tourist visa, and they overstay. Our system needs beefed up. We need to have better tracking of people that come to our country that are on visas, and we need to be able to follow where they are. And when they don't leave, they need to be forced to leave our country. Again, if you tried this in any other country in the world, they catch you and deport you. Almost every other country in the world. So it's, again, a false political narrative out there that people like me are not don't want people to immigrate to our country. That's not true. We take more people every year, as I said, than every other country in the world combined, legally. And also, I've been in Israel a couple times in Jerusalem. You may or may not know this, but they built a wall around the city of Jerusalem, and the Jewish area of the city, because they were having so much trouble with suicide bombers, people with backpacks walking into a local, you'd be sitting outside having having lunch, and somebody would walk up and blow up a bunch of people in Israel, and they were all coming from other areas of the country. They put a wall around Israel and made it difficult for people to do that, and that situation went to almost zero. And I posted this from Benjamin Netanyahu on my website, and they put a wall along their southern border, Israel did, and it doesn't completely stop people coming from Sinai, terrorists coming from the Sinai Peninsula into Israel, but it almost cut it to zero with a physical barrier. So if done properly, physical barriers in combination with internal enforcement, with enforcing the laws that are already in the books, expanding our electronic surveillance and border security guards and letting them do their jobs, and also in fairness to people who are claiming asylum and other reasons why they're coming here, get some expansion of the legal system, which they're going to work on, so that people can get their cases adjudicated quickly and a decision is made, and if the decision is made that they're granted asylum, give them that status. Don't bring people, we've heard anywhere from 3 to 5 years court dates, of which a high percentage never show up, and just release them into the United, let them stay in the United States. You just can't do that. That's just not good policy.
Another question from Abby. Will you work to ensure the rights for the LGBT community?
Yes, I don't believe in discriminating against anybody. We're all citizens.
Do you favor opening federal lands, including national parks, for oil and mineral exploration?
Well, there's restrictions, right? That's not a yes or no answer. That is with conditions, and it has to be approved on an individual basis by the Department of the Interior. So that's, again, an executive branch decision. But, I think here's the thing. Around here we have some federal land. But out west, certain states, the federal government owns almost the entire state. And so when you look at it, you have to look at it from a national perspective. But I think those decisions need to be made, are being made by the Department of Interior on a case-by-case basis. They have to meet certain criteria. They have to comply with the law, and they have to make sure that they are complying with the environmental laws that are on the books, and that their impact on the environment is consistent with U.S. law.
This is from Bradford, from Odin. Exactly how serious is the North Korean situation, and do you believe the U.S. should and would respond if provoked?
Honestly, I think I'm trying to think of what I can say publicly about the situation. I don't think it's as bad as it's being portrayed. I do think, and the reason I say that is because behind the scenes, the Chinese are helping more than is being portrayed. I mean, and are putting more pressure on North Korea than they have in a long time. And so I also don't think that, although the leader of North Korea, in most people's opinion, is unstable mentally, that he's dumb enough to provoke the United States of America. I don't know. But I think it's leveling off a little bit in the past week. I think we need to keep a close eye on it. It is a dangerous risk. Like I said, when we were in Japan, that was one of their biggest issues, right? Security of South Korea, Japan, and other U.S. allies in the region. But the Chinese have some security concerns too, because they're right there, right? The thing about why China isn't so important, because essentially all the energy, all the power, the electrical power that North Korea has, comes from China. I mean, they basically could shut off their energy supply. And the other thing is, China is one of the few countries in the world that still is trading anything with them because of the sanctions that have been put on around the world, at least that we know of. So, we're keeping a good eye on it. We'll see when we get back this week again, because it's been things have happened during the Easter recess. But I think it's calming down a little bit. I don't think the United States, it's not in our best interest in my opinion, to overreact in that region. I think the good news is that China is recognizing that, and things are calming down a little bit.
Why did you vote to sell our private internet data?
Good question. I didn't. And here, let me tell you, this is another issue. So what it's a complicated issue, but it basically has to do with which federal agency has jurisdiction over certain parts of the internet. Okay, is it the FTC or the FCC, the Federal Trade Commission or the Federal Communications Commission? Okay, and so what the FCC did under the previous director and the Obama administration is passed a rule that said that the FCC was going to take some jurisdiction from the FTC for broadband providers. But here's the kicker. People like Google and Yahoo and Facebook and all of those were not affected by this rule. It basically was bifurcating the regulatory process for the internet. Does that make sense? So what happened is, Republicans thought that was a bad idea. And guess what? It's not only our opinion. The FTC chairman, and I think you can probably see that video on my website. The FTC chairman under the Obama administration said this was a really bad idea and was against the rule, but the FCC, they had an agency battle in the executive branch. The FCC went ahead with it, and so all we did is, we didn't change anything. First of all, the rule had not been implemented. See what I'm saying? So the rule was passed, but the FCC rule, had not gone into effect yet. And so the current FCC chairman and FTC chairman and the Obama administration FTC chairman thought that this was a bad rule because it bifurcated the jurisdiction on the internet, didn't affect people like Google, Facebook, and everybody else, who are the ones, for the most part, who are monitoring what you do on the internet. I mean, how many of you have had, one day you're on a website shopping for shoes, and the next day you go onto the internet to a different site, and all of a sudden you got a bunch of shoe ads on your. I mean, I've had that happen. That's Google. That's whoever that's doing that. It's not the broadband providers and other, the cable providers of the world that are doing that. So this rule wouldn't have affected any of those. It would just have bifurcated it, so we overturned it. And I voted to overturn it because the information that we got from, again, President Obama's FTC chairman, as well as the new people, just overall thought it was a bad idea. Has no effect on your privacy or anything you do on the internet. The rule had not been implemented, and all it did was change jurisdiction. So, again, the political narrative, again, is one of, how do you come up with something that is going to get people's attention? And the people that were against what we did, even though they were going against President Obama's own FCTC chairman, thought that if you just tell people we're going to authorize people to take your internet information, that's going to get people's attention. It's just flat out not true.
Marcia from Vincent's asked, the Wall Street Journal reported today that ExxonMobil renewed its application for a waiver to get around Russian economic sanctions to work with a state oil company. What is your position on waivers to avoid sanctions?
Yeah, I saw the headline because I follow the Wall Street Journal online, but I didn't read the article. And tomorrow, I didn't have time. I just did it in the car, read it in the car on the, this afternoon. I really haven't had a chance to look at it. And I just haven't had a chance to look at it. I don't know what their proposal is. No, actually, it's not. It's more complicated than that, because there's all kinds of people, all kinds of American companies that get waivers from these things.
All right. Abby asks, how are you working to protect us from gun violence?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, I support the Second Amendment. And if you follow me, you know that. The bigger picture stuff, it's a complicated subject. But if you look at Chicago, for example, my son lives in Chicago, and they're having a problem right now. He lives in an area that's not affected. There's a neighborhood on the west side, neighborhood on the south side. What's driving gun violence in Chicago? Well, in the city of Chicago, legally, you can't have a weapon, my understanding. I mean, if you look at the gun laws, it's like New York. If you get caught with a weapon, you go to jail for 3 years in New York. So these are all illegal, and it's driven by primarily in areas like Chicago, primarily by gang activity and drugs. So on a bigger picture, what can the feds do? What can a member of Congress do about that? Well, we can help try to make sure that local law enforcement agencies have some of the resources they need to combat the problem. We can do things like what we're doing with the opioid situation, as I described earlier, to try to decrease the amount of drugs. We can secure the southern border of the United States so that we prevent all of the drugs from coming in, because it's not just people across the southern border. It's drugs is a big problem. So it's a comprehensive approach. We can secure the southern border to help the flow of drugs into our country. And I think, honestly, as a society, like happened in New York City. I mean, in New York City in the 80s, it was a mess. And the mayor there, the one that preceded Giuliani and then Giuliani, they had to work through a cultural change in their neighborhoods for people, law-abiding people, not to accept, you know, just not to accept this type of activity in their neighborhood. I mean, it takes everybody. You're not going to be able to, without buy-in from the communities that are involved, it's going to be a problem. And so, you know, as it relates to the law enforcement, you know, in some areas of our country, you know, there people I'm not passing judgment on people, but people just don't interact with the law enforcement people like they do here in southern Indiana. And Chicago's got a big problem with that right now. They have one of the issues that's increased their gun violence is, in my opinion, and this is a political opinion, the mayor up there has almost promoted an anti-law enforcement climate in the city. And you're seeing the result. The Chicago Police Department has said, that's fine. We're going to essentially not risk our lives in certain areas of the city if we're going to get played Monday morning quarterback all the time. Now, that said, you know, that when people violate the law, whether that's me or law enforcement or whomever, they need to be held accountable. So it's a bigger problem, I think, than people want to oversimplify it and say, well, if we would just rid our communities of all these weapons. First of all, there's millions and millions of them. Second of all, people have their Second Amendment rights. And most people here in law-abiding citizens in southwest Indiana and the Wabash Valley have respect for the rule of law and have guns and things that they use for all kinds of things in a lawful way. I just think the feds need to have this big comprehensive approach like I've described and tackle it in multiple areas. But we really, all of us as citizens, I think, have to, especially in the areas of the country that are struggling with this, we have to have an overall cultural change. Like I said, in New York, for example, how do you do that as a government? Well, in the bad areas of New York that had some of these, where there was graffiti on the subway, every night they cleaned it completely off. So every day when you went to that neighborhood, it was all gone. Other people, primarily areas like Times Square and Hell's Kitchen, which is in Midtown, they started to do things like not allow nefarious businesses in their communities. You know, in New York, it was X-rated stuff. It's a complicated solution.
Robert from Terre Haute asks, when will you hold a town hall meeting in Terre Haute?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, we're going to look at our calendar. You know, I cover 19 counties, and so I get all over, and we keep track of how many times I've been in different counties. And over the years, the last time I did a town hall in Terre Haute was in 2015, because last year I explained this to people at another thing. I generally have done these in the August recess and in the fall, but last year in the election year, because the things were so polarized, when we assessed that, we thought it was going to be a security risk, because not for necessarily for us, but because there were so many people in the crowd that had such strong opinions about their candidate that it was a security issue. I know people don't think that's true, but we have to look at these things. I mean, you can just see here tonight what we take security seriously, not only for me, but for you. And we want to make sure public events are safe and everybody has a chance to participate. So we'll see. I mean, as we go through the rest of the calendar year, we'll see when it comes up.
Brenda from Mount Vernon says, thank you for caring about Hoosiers by hosting job fairs. Any soon?
Yeah, we just had a job fair in Evansville a few weeks ago. Unfortunately, I got stuck in D.C. and missed it. That was the healthcare thing where we got stayed till Friday and then I missed it. But they're ongoing. I would suggest you look at and my staff can tell you when the next one is, but we do these in Evansville, Terre Haute. We've done them historically in Jasper and Vincennes. And we had it in the Evansville, we had a great turnout. Excuse me. We had the most employers that we've ever had and the most job opportunities that we've ever had. And those are all the way from entry-level jobs all the way to professional positions. You'd be surprised. And I think the one thing that we do at all of these, the first hour is for veterans only at these events. And why is that? Well, because veteran unemployment is still higher than the rest of the general population. So in the first hour, we focus on those. But my staff will be able to tell you when the next one is.
Lola asks, what is the most difficult part of your job?
I would say it's the personal stuff. It's the traveling back and forth and time away from your family. That's the most difficult part of the job.
Okay, sorry. I know. I'm trying to figure this. Okay, I can skip this one until I can figure it out.
You can say a commercial. This is...
Yeah. Can you commit that you will not vote to increase the defense budget at the expense of programs to keep our children and elderly cared for?
Yeah, we talked about that earlier, right? The defense budget, the proposal of the president's budget is to increase defense spending, which we need to do. But as I also said, there's a lot of programs in the budget which we're not going to zero out. I mean, we need to look at. And I think I went over the budget problem and how difficult it is right now. But we'll look at all of those things. We want, there's a lot of good discretionary programs that we're not going to cut.
This is and I'm trying to be respectful of everyone's questions, but make sure we also don't have a ton of overlap here. But I'll go through a few of these. Do you support legalization of marijuana?
No.
Do you support government funding for development of renewable energy?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. As I said earlier, I'm an all-the-above energy person. I think I said that. And I believe we need to advance technology and innovation in all energy sectors.
What will you do to make Indiana less dependent on fossil fuels?
Well, it's already happening, right? I mean, it's across the country. Again, innovation, technological advances, and, you know, it's a national issue. Our area, though, excuse me, there's a fly. Our area, though, as of about a year or so ago, our state, about 80% of our electrical power was from coal. Now that's dropping because of the low price of natural gas and people have converted over. But, again, I support people innovating and advancing technology to, you know, to have the least amount of impact on our environment. But also, as I also said, make sure that it's not devastating to our economy in Southwest Indiana and the Wabash Valley. And I think we can balance that. The other issue on that is reliability of our energy sources. And that's an issue I think that's not doesn't get a lot of press, but it should. Because in areas of the world which have a large volumes of renewable energy, more than we do here, they've had some issues with grid with reliability because when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, they have to figure out how to make up for that. And what they do in Europe, for example, is if, say, a coal-fired power plant's running at 60% and then they have less input to their baseload energy from renewables, they ramp up the coal-fired power plant to 90% to make up for that. Well, that doesn't really get you anywhere, right? Because if you're doing that all the time, it doesn't, you know, you can feel better about yourself maybe that you're using renewable energy a lot, but we have to make sure that it's reliable. And one area of innovation that is really exciting is in energy storage. And there's a lot of people working on that research, including at the Battery Innovation Center outside of Crane. That is a really, really critical thing to work on is energy storage. So say you have energy generated by the sun, that you can store that. Right now, it's not as feasible. And that, you know, so... But also, again, there's a coal-fired power plant in South Texas that's using carbon capture. It's online. It's working. They're using that carbon that they capture, the CO2 that they capture, to reinfuse essentially dead oil wells because, as you know, oil comes out of the ground when there's pressure behind it. Once the pressure goes down, the output of the oil well stops. They don't suck it out. It comes out with pressure. So they're using the CO2 from this coal-fired power plant to reinfuse those wells and increase their productivity. So that's technology that is advancing.
With the Hyde Amendment in place prohibiting federal fundings from being used for abortion except in cases of rape, incest, and endangerment, why do you feel the need to also prohibit federal funds from going to family planning places like Planned Parenthood just because some locations provide abortions?
Because Planned Parenthood performs about 325,000 abortions a year, and I'm pro-life.
So the follow-up to that would be, why did you vote for prohibiting federal funds from being used by Planned Parenthood, but the same day voted against prohibiting spending tax money on NASCAR sponsorship back in February of 2011?
That's more complicated. Actually, that was the National Guard, right, that did that. And let me tell you why. Because the National Guard, one of their big places they can recruit is at NASCAR races, believe it or not. And I also thought that it was meddling from Congress. Okay, what are we going to decide? We're going to look at every little thing that every agency does and say, well, you're not going to do – Congress is going to pass a law that says you can't do this and that. I thought the National Guard has their budget. The National Guard knows what it takes to market, to recruit people. And it's not for Congress to say that's the case. And the reality is when you talk to the National Guard, and I have, they'll tell you, obviously, that population of people that both watch on TV and show up at races, are a big potential pool of recruits that tend to sign up.
All right, we have a couple of questions that sort of overlap, and they concern Medicare changes and the health bill protection against rising costs, both the program and the prescriptions.
Medicare,
yes.
Now, Medicare in the current health care debate is not being discussed. Essentially, the Affordable Care Act essentially doesn't have – it's a different issue. Medicare is a different issue. Rising drug costs are an issue for all of us. And I've met with all the stakeholders all the way from the people that do R&D, like Lilly, all the way to the pharmacies, to everybody in between, to try to get a handle on this problem. And we're going to. And what I've said is that we need to have all the stakeholders give us ideas to get these drug prices down quickly, or I think Congress in a bipartisan way is going to start looking at ways to address it, which I'm a free market person. I want free market solutions. But again, I'm on the Committee of Jurisdiction for a lot of healthcare stuff. I've met with all the stakeholders. It's a real problem. In fact, I met with the CEO of Mylan, you know, the EpiPen situation, you know, where it went up so high people couldn't afford it, and had a conversation with her. And she happens to be the daughter of Senator Manchin from West Virginia, by the way, and said, look, every stakeholder needs to help Congress and help us do what we can to get these prices down. It's a very complicated situation. It also has to do with what insurance companies now are covering. So, as again, the exchanges and other and the costs are going up for everybody, how are insurance companies trying to get a handle on that? They're decreasing what's called the formulary, which is the number of medicines that they cover for. And so what's happened is that in some instances, people that say, well, I was on a certain medication for years, it cost me $10 a time, now it's $200 a time. Well, that's because your insurance company changed their coverage, and they don't cover as much because of insurance losses in other areas. I'm not saying that's right, but I'm saying this is the way the marketplace reacts, and we're going to have to do something about it.
Tony asks, do hospitals get audited on what they charge for Medicare services? I see some extravagant charges.
They get reimbursed based on a fee schedule. So what happens is, like I said before, the whole way we pay for health care is really complicated and a little messed up. On the Medicare side, you can charge whatever you want, but there's a fee schedule and you get paid that amount. So will you see, you know, a disparity between charges between hospitals? Yes. The reason is, because if you take Medicare, it's illegal to charge people a different price for the same product. Okay? So, for example, I was a heart surgeon. Okay? Even though Medicare would only reimburse a certain amount, but say Anthem would reimburse twice that amount, you can't charge the patient for the actual amount that the insurer is going to reimburse you. See what I'm saying? So you can't charge and that makes total sense, right? You can't charge a Medicare patient a certain amount and then say, well, this next patient has Anthem, so I'm going to charge them what Anthem would pay me, which might be double that. It may not be. It's getting closer. So what you see hospitals do is they charge everybody above what the private insurer would pay them. So even if you're on Medicare, right, you'll get charged a rate which is higher than the highest amount that hospital would get from any insurance company for that procedure, because it's illegal to charge people differently. So that's why the system's messed up. So you get the same bill as regardless of what insurance you're on. But what the hospital actually gets paid is based on a negotiated fee schedule with Medicare. Well, Medicare doesn't negotiate, by the way. They just say, here's the fee schedule, take it or leave it. Medicaid, same thing. But with the private insurance companies, based on a negotiated fee schedule. And so that's what they get paid. So the charges really matter, but they really don't. It's because everything is based on fee schedules that are negotiated.
All right. There is a definite need for simplification on taxes, but tax reform seems to be a euphemism for tax cuts for the extremely wealthy. The claim is that even though we're $19 trillion in debt, that the economy is going strong, and there's problems with wash sales, publicly traded partnerships, S-corporations, et cetera. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah, we'll see where that comes down. I mean, tax reform is necessary on the corporate side for sure. And here's the reason why, and some of you may disagree with that, but hear me out. The rest of the world taxes their corporations differently than we do. First of all, companies that are based in America, if they have profits overseas, 95% of the world's consumers are not in the United States. So big companies are going to have to are going to have to service those 95%, right? That's just the way it works. Their profits overseas don't come back here. They stay over there, wherever that is. And the reason is because if they bring it back, they get taxed at a really high rate by the American government. Which is the top rate's 35%. So they essentially get double taxed. They get taxed in the country where they make the profit. Then if they bring the money back to the United States, they get taxed by us again, and companies won't do that. They just say, fine, we're going to keep our asset, we're going to keep our money overseas. Every other developed country in the world, except for us, doesn't do that. Right? They make the what is called repatriation of money, bringing money back to their country at a rate which is competitive, so that their companies based in their country can move their money around their company, regardless of which country the profits are in. And so if we don't, it's called a territorial tax system, if we don't change that, we're going to continue to be less competitive, because other countries around the world for the last decade or so have been dropping their rates for their corporations, essentially to attract American companies to come there. And so we're going to have to address that. And people say, well, you know, you're making a big tax cut for corporations. Well, the reality is this, is that if companies bring that money back from overseas and reinvest it in America, and also it's inhibiting their ability, again, this is not my opinion, this is what, I'm just telling you what they do. They're publicly held companies that are going to do what the market lets them do. They would reinvest a lot of that money in America. They would also, in my view, be incentivized to keep the manufacturing in the United States, create more high-paying jobs in the United States, because one of the problems we have is a lot of our traditional manufacturing jobs have gone away from automation and also offshoring, combination of those. And so in the overall scheme of things, you know, if you create more high-paying jobs, those employees are paying taxes. You have people at higher level employment. It does a couple things. First of all, it makes their quality of life much better. Second of all, it increases revenue on the personal tax side to make sure that that we have the resources we need to fund all our programs. So the controversy is this, right? The controversy is always who, you know, on the personal side, what do you do with the tax rates? So the angle that if you decrease the top tax rate, most people, you know, a lot of people like Sanders and others want to double or triple that. I saw somebody on TV the other day who wants to make the top tax rate 80%. So anytime we try to adjust that, we get accused of tax breaks for the wealthy. And so it's a difficult situation because, you know, I want tax rates to go down for everybody. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, in our country, there's a tendency to punish success. I mean, I have kids. I want them to go to college, be as successful as possible, and do as well as they can, and then a good portion of our population wants to punish them by saying, you need to turn in more of that money to the federal government. We're always going to have a progressive tax code. It's always going to be progressive. Now, that's the percentage. And I see people shaking their heads. They disagree with me. But let me tell you what the situation is. The top 10% in dollar amounts, not percentage of income, roughly the top 10% or so of income people in the United States in absolute dollar amounts, depending on the year, pay about 70% of absolute dollars in taxes. The top 10% pay 70% in dollars of the taxes. So if you go to the top 20%, you know, you're looking at 90%. The top 50% of tax earners in the country pay 100% of it. So my question is okay, you can say, okay, the percentage is there, but I think it's important to recognize what the real facts are. The real facts are the top 10% of earners already pay 70% of the dollars into the so are we wanting to them to pay, you know, 95% of it, or what? Where are we supposed to go with that? I want taxes to be as low as possible on everybody that can still fund the government programs that are necessary. That's my position.
All right, the next question focuses on the Medicare for high-income individuals and the cutoff. So this person received a large income from the sale of some land, and at $1 over $170,000 cutoff, you had to pay an extra $53 per month for Medicare Part B and $1,330 per month for D. That's $1,603 if you were just $1 over. It's even worse for the next category. It would be $4,034 per year. Couldn't this be broken into smaller brackets to minimize the problem?
I'll be honest with you. I don't know the details of that enough to comment on it. I really don't. I'm being totally honest. But there are different cutoff lines in these programs, and if you're a dollar or two over, it's a problem. But you have to cut off things somewhere. But I honestly don't know the details enough of exactly where the cutoffs are and all that to really give a more detailed answer.
Do you have any concerns over public officials self-promoting themselves?
Yes. And we've had some problems with that recently. You can't do that. It's illegal. You can't do that.
All right. Now, the last questions I have, I think, kind of go over the some categories that we have already discussed. But in fairness, we do have some time. I'm going to try to read all these and give everybody a fair shot. Mona asks, I would like to know if you support the general public having a health care that is at least as good and as cheap as what congressmen receive.
I'm on Obamacare. I'm on the exchanges. So the answer is absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
Wendy and Dave ask basically the same question insofar as it's the Affordable Care Act has helped so many people. Why will you not support modifying the ACA and correct identified deficiencies instead of repeal and starting over?
Yeah, well, the ACA has insured about roughly 20 million people, maybe 22 million people. That's the one concept I want to get as a takeaway from this. The ACA is not insuring the vast majority of people in our country. They're insured by Medicare, Medicaid, and their employer-based health insurance. Okay? That's the facts. That's not my opinion. That's just the facts. And then we have 25 to 27 million people who are still uninsured, most of those people by choice. Some because they're being priced out of the marketplace now in the exchanges, because they're just at the level where they can't get a subsidy, but they can't afford the premium, and so they're getting priced out. But that's a really, really small number of people, in fairness. So, you know, we need to address, like I said earlier, we need to address a couple areas. We need to address the Medicaid program and make sure that it is solid for the people that it was originally supposed to be for, our fellow citizens, and we need to figure out what we're going to do in this exchange situation. Excuse me. When the exchanges go under, which they're going to if we don't do anything. And so, you know, we're trying to those exchange people, remember, are in the individual marketplace. These are people that are purchasing insurance that they're not, where they're not getting insurance through a federal program or a traditional federal program or through their employer. And it's about roughly 10 to 12 million people. The Congressional Budget Office said it'd be 20 million. It's half that. But we need to address that, absolutely. And my fear is that we can't come to some agreement in D.C. about how to do that. When the exchanges go away, 10 million people are going to lose their insurance. Now, you know, there's a difference of opinion. Like I said, Senator Sanders would say, that's not a problem, just put everybody on Medicare. That I can just tell you that's just, in my opinion, a bad idea. But we can't allow our fellow citizens not to have options. One of the reasons they don't have options is because the Affordable Care Act is very prescriptive about what has to be in it's a one-size-fits-all insurance plan, right? We need to free that up a little bit so that there are more affordable options for people if they choose. Our legislation expands health savings accounts so that people can, it doubles it, so that people can have a health savings account, double what they can now. It's roughly $6,000 when you double it, ballparkish, to help them pay for routine medical expenses. But here's the problem, right? If you just do that and you don't allow other insurance products in the marketplace, then they can't afford the policy above the HSA. Where does that leave people? So even though, I get it, even though the healthcare law mandated insurance companies cover certain things, which I don't necessarily disagree with, but it gives no flexibility to also offer other products that people can afford, that they can choose, that maybe the right thing for them. I mean, if you're a 22-year-old, I've got a 24 and 22-year-old. I mean, a big HSA with a policy above an HSA that's low cost works perfectly for them, but it won't work for other people. So, we're working on it. I mean, it's a very partisan, polarized situation. It's a shame, really. But we have offered, I can tell you, over the last 6 years, ideas to change things in the Affordable Care Act, and we couldn't get any support to do it.
The president would veto.
What are you going to do to address the pollution crisis in southern Indiana, and are you concerned that infant mortality rates in southern Indiana are 9.4%?
On the second question, yes. And the infant mortality rate is a complicated – I'll address that first because it's there's a combination of factors. One of the big factors is drug abuse.
Well, the big factor is pollution is not being addressed.
One of the big – I'm getting to that. One of the big factors is drug abuse. The only pediatric surgery I did adults, was a particular operation on premature infants in the neonatal intensive care unit at St. Mary's, okay? And when you talk to the people in the neonatal intensive care units, they will tell you that a high percentage of those babies are from addicted mothers that were born prematurely, and many of them are born earlier than that in a non-survivable age. And some are born at an age where they can survive in the neonatal intensive care unit, and I did surgery on those people. So that's one factor. So addressing the drug issue is a big part of it. The Southern Indiana has problems with air quality. I mean, nobody's disagreeing with that. And, part of that is our demographics is why – I mean, our topography. It's why Denver has a problem with more than some other cities. You would think Denver, it's in the middle of Colorado. Well, it's backed up against the mountains on one side, and it's just where it is. It's in a valley type thing. But the reality is, we rely on the coal industry and the natural gas industry in the Midwest for our energy generation. And I think I went through that before, that I'm for advancing technology and innovation that constantly improves on that situation without damaging our local economy and causing people jobs.
All right. Cricket and Linda ask in a parallel questions. Representative Bill Pascrell is circulating a letter that would instruct Congress to use its authority to require President Trump to release his tax returns. We would like to see that. Is there any foreign interest we should be concerned about?
I don't know, because he hasn't released his tax returns. And I'm for him releasing his tax returns. I'm against Congress doing partisan things like Bill Pascrell is. And he's doing it every week, the same thing. And then as soon as he does it, his party sends out fundraising emails and blast emails into every district where they have targeted races. So, if you want to really address the problem, I think, the American people think he should – release his tax returns. I do too, and he should voluntarily release his tax returns.
Okay. That's the end of the questions that we have. The written questions that we had. So if you have some follow-ups, there's congressman staffs here, and we can probably go through them a few at a time. But for right now, that's how we're going to – thank you.
Okay, thanks again, everyone. That wraps up our Town Hall broadcast on Memories 107.9 WAMW-FM Washington. We will be uploading this file sometime tomorrow for those that may have missed part of it and would like to get a rebroadcast at WAMWAMFM.com. I'm Dave Crooks, live from North Elementary School in Washington, and that concludes our special Town Hall broadcast from DLC Media and WAMW-FM. Have a good evening.